We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session September 19, 2013, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Sequoia Energy LLC, docket number Kent 2008-1059. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, Commissioner Nakamura, and Commissioner Alton. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Sarah Stewart. Good afternoon, Sarah.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Commissioners. On February 8, 2008, Engine Inspector Ross inspected Sequoia Energy Coal Preparation Plant. The inspector issued four citations to Sequoia relating to notable equipment defects. The cited equipment was refuse trucks that were generally used to haul refuse about a quarter mile from refuse bins to a refuse puddle. I will describe those four citations. Inspector Brock issued citation number 749-6260 to Sequoia, alleging a significant and substantial violation of 30 CFR section 77.404A because he observed that a refuse truck, a soft truck, had a leak that permitted carbon monoxide to enter the driver's compartment. Section 77.404A provides that mobile and stationary equipment and machinery shall be maintained in safe operating conditions, and machinery or equipment in unsafe conditions shall be removed from service immediately. The citation was later modified to include allegations that the high and low beam highlights on the right side of the truck were not removed. The inspector issued a second citation, 749-6262, to Sequoia, alleging another violation of section 77.404A, because he observed that a refuse truck had a broken upper left side mirror and a missing lower left side mirror. The citation was also modified to include allegations that the high and low beam headlights on the right side of the truck were not visible. The third citation, 749-6263, alleged an estimate violation of 30 CFR section 77.1104, because Inspector Voss observed a combustible material in the form of hydraulic oil accumulated on the hood of the refuse truck that was also the subject of the second thing. Section 77.1104 provides that combustible materials, grease, lubricants, paint, or flammable liquids shall not be allowed to accumulate where they can create a fire. Finally, the inspector issues a fourth citation, number 749-6266, alleging a violation of 30 CFR section 77.410C because the backup alarm on a truck was not maintained in functional condition. And section 77.410C provides that warning devices shall be maintained in functional condition. After the hearing, the judge found that the secretary had established all four violations and that all four violations were evident. With respect to the first citation ending in 6-0, the judge concluded that the leaking exhaust pipe alone was enough for concluding that the violation was evident, and he did not include consideration of the damaged lights in his estimate analysis. The judge next accepted the secretary's position that negligence as to that violation was moderate. However, he noted that several mitigating factors were present related to the traffic. He found that the hazard caused by the truck's inoperative lights was mitigated by supplemental lighting at the refuse bins, and at the refuse pile. He also noted that Sequoia's mechanic had testified that all the trucks had supplemental lighting mounted on top of them, and that the inspector did not refute this testimony, but merely stated that he does not recall which of any additional lights were on the truck. As to the exhaust pipe, the judge stated that the condition was not readily visibly apparent, and that the inspector did not contend that the defective exhaust pipe had been notified pre-shift vendor. The judge also stated that although the inspector testified that Sequoia had been previously warned, the secretary does not contend that Sequoia's history of violations reflects an inadequate emphasis on the importance of maintaining equipment in safe operating conditions. The judge concluded, therefore, that there were significant circumstances related to the degree of gravity, and he assessed the penalty of $1,400 rather than the proposed sentence date of 4689. As to the second citation ending in 6-2, the judge concluded that the cracked and missing side reading note alone provided an adequate basis for designating the violation as open text, and he also did not include consideration of the inoperative license assessment in the note. The judge again accepted the secretary's position that the negligence was moderate, but found that there were significant mitigating circumstances related to the degree of gravity. The judge reasoned that the upper mirror was still functional, although it was cracked. He also stated that the lower mirror is used to look at the truck's rear tires, and that the missing lower mirror would not normally be relied on because the truck did not jump in the vicinity of an elevated area. The judge also said that the mitigating factors relating to the headlights with respect to the first citation were applicable again with respect to the second citation. Accordingly, the judge assessed a penalty of $1,200 rather than the proposed penalty of $4,689. The judge found that the accumulation violation set forth in the third citation was as null, because he concluded that it was reasonably likely that the ignition hazard created by the presence of the hydraulic oil as a source of fuel would likely result in an event such as a fire or an explosion, which could cause serious or fatal injury to the operator of the refuge truck. The judge further found that rather than the moderate negligence alleged in the citation, the violation resulted from at least a moderately high degree of negligence. The judge reasoned that the condition was obvious, and the secretary had alleged that the condition had been noted for several shifts in the pre-shift examination. The judge then assessed the penalty of $3,500 rather than the proposed penalty of $5,503. As for the fourth citation, the judge concluded that the violation of section 77.410 was S&S, concluding that it was reasonably likely that the hazard created by a non-functioning backup alarm would result in a serious or fatal injury to someone positioned behind the truck. The judge concluded that the violation resulted from moderate negligence rather than the degree of high negligence alleged in the citation. He noted that the secretary alleged that the condition had existed for a significant period of time and was noted in the pre-shift examination book, but he reasoned that the alarm was exposed to mud, which prevented it from working, and that it was cleaned from time to time, although Sequoia's mechanic did not report the cleaning. The judge reasoned that although the mudding conditions were a mitigating factor, the operator was responsible for maintaining the alarm in constant condition. Accordingly, he assessed the penalty of $2,200 rather than the proposed penalty of $3,996. With respect to all four of the penalties that issued, the judge noted parenthetically that previous penalties confirming the operator's failure to correct defects on mobile equipment ranged from $50 to $400, compared to the range of $3,996 to $5,503 currently proposed for the fourth citation. The judge recognized the secretary's concern that Sequoia needed to deploy greater effort in maintaining its equipment, but stated that his assessment was significantly greater than previous assessment, but it adequately addressed the secretary's concern. On review, the secretary argues that the judge erred in his assessment of the four penalties. First, he contends that the judge relied upon past penalty amounts to arrive at the subject penalty. The secretary notes that besides that consideration amounting to an error by itself, the judge further neglected to consider that NJ amended 30 CFR Part 100 in 2007. And that those amendments resulted in higher proposed penalties, so that the subject proposed penalties would be higher than past penalties. Second, the secretary contends that the judge erred in equating the absence of aggravating factors to the presence of mitigating factors in determining the penalty. The secretary further asserts that the judge erred in reducing the penalties without providing an adequate explanation, particularly with respect to citation number 7496263 regarding the hydraulic oil. Accordingly, the secretary states that in the interest of judicial economy, the commission should reinstate the penalties originally proposed by the secretary. The question then on review is whether the judge erred in his assessment of penalties for the four violations. I would be happy to answer the question.
Thank you.
Anybody have questions for Sarah at this point? I'd like to thank Sarah, because I know I have taken up several chunks of your time asking you to discuss various parts of the record or confirm parts of the record or just debate certain issues. So I appreciate that. And we are going to start off our deliberations with Commissioner Nakamura.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. And I also want to thank Sarah for all her help. Hopefully I understand the penalty assessments now. I think probably the thing that I learned the most is confusing. and there are probably a lot of people here in the courtroom who know this better than I do, so I'll try to be as accurate as possible. Let me begin by speaking about the citation number 749-6263. That was the citation issued by the Secretary for a violation of 75.1104, the oil on the truck near the turbocharger. And I agree with the Secretary that the judge erred by reducing that penalty without adequate explanation. This is particularly true because the judge upheld the violation, upheld the S&S finding, indicated that the violation was of high gravity, and stated that not only was the operator's negligence moderate, but that it was at least moderately high. And it seems to me that the judge found the negligence the conduct of a higher degree of negligence. Nonetheless, he reduced the penalty from about $5,500 to $3,500, so a couple thousand dollars, without apparent explanation. So I would remand that citation for that reason. But wait, there actually is at least an apparent explanation for the judge's reduction that comes later in the opinion. I think you alluded to in the summary. And that's on page 12 at the end, where he says, and I'll quote this, "I note parenthetically that the previous penalties proposed by the Secretary for violations concerning Sequoia's failure to correct defects on mobile equipment ranged from $60 to $400, compared to $3,996 to $5,503 range currently proposed by the Secretary for the four adjudicated citations." He goes on, "I recognize the Secretary's concern that Sequoia needs to display greater efforts to maintain its heavy-duty refuse trucks regardless of their operation under adverse conditions. The imposition of the civil penalties from $1,200 to $3,500 in this case that are significantly greater than the previous assessments imposed by the Secretary for similar violations adequately addresses the Secretary's concern." I agree with the Secretary that the judge made reference to past violations and citations, whether or not that's contrary to Commission precedent, I don't think is that clear. But clearly, he was, in this case, referring to penalties that had been proposed by the Secretary under the old penalty scheme. And there, I think if you look at the old scheme and the new scheme, you would see that there's that the amendments explain why there was such a great increase in the proposed penalties. Just as an example, I calculated what the proposed penalties would have been under the old scheme for this particular citation, and it would have been $629. Compare that to the points under the new scheme, the penalty would have been $6,115, but there was a 10% a reduction for the abatement. So that brought it down to $5,503. So if you look at the preamble to the new penalty regulations, when it came out in the Federal Register, what you will see is that the new penalty scheme greatly increases the points for the gravity criteria. Also negligence, but in this case, primarily the gravity criteria was the big factor that that increased the penalty. And that's particularly with respect to the likelihood of occurrence. In our case, I think the judge did affirm the S&S violation, and the there would have been, I think, so that there was a likelihood, a reasonable likelihood of an occurrence. And under the new regulations, that would have equal to 30 points. If the judge had, or if the occurrence had been reduced, likelihood of occurrence had been reduced to unlikely, it would have reduced the point total by 20 points, and the actual dollar penalty by about $5,000. So there was a significant policy decision to increase the penalties for violations that were found to be significant and substantial. And it doesn't appear to me that the judge recognized this when he made that statement in his decision. Now, I know that under commission precedent, that a judge does not have to conform his assessment of penalties to the secretary's penalty point system. But it seems to me, if he does make reference to it, and I think his statements certainly do implicate it, because he mentions them and then and makes this error. If he does make reference to them or implicate them in some way, then it has to be based on an accurate knowledge of which point systems he's talking about, and why, and explain why there was this difference. And I don't think he did that in this case, or at least recognized that there was this amendment. So to me, this discussion, this so-called parenthetical, causes me to want to remand all four citations and not just the one I initially talked about. Because it's possible, given what he said here, it's hard to know here, but to send this back to him with the knowledge that these earlier penalties were under the old system, and then let him reassess under the authority that he has under the Act. So I would vacate all four and remand for reassessment. Let's see. The Secretary also argued, I guess, that the judge erred in, I think, the first two citations, and that he looked at, I think, the knowledge factors and said that these were mitigating factors. I don't think he did that. I think he says, let's see, the Secretary argued that they had argued that the operator had knowledge and had actually asked for increased penalties. And the judge actually had used his finding of a lack of knowledge to reduce the penalties. And I don't think the judge made that mistake here, if it is a mistake. I think he rejected the secretary's evidence that the operator had knowledge, and then affirmed the moderate negligence finding rather than increase the negligence finding. So I don't see that the judge erred on that on those grounds. I guess lastly, the secretary asks us to assess the penalties at this at the commission level, and I think I've already stated that I'm not willing to do that, and I would remand all four.
Thank you, Commissioner Nakamura. Next, Commissioner Alton.
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. Sir, I want to I don't want to thank you for giving me all this information. You've made me flip-flop on this case more than a tune in a boat. And flipped from decided one way, decided the other way, and I'm probably sort of flipping around undecided right now. However, I appreciate hearing Commissioner Nakamura's remarks very much because they were, I think, very insightful and useful to my deliberation. I look forward to hearing my colleagues' comments also. I will start with the sort of general overriding objections raised by the Secretary. And there, the case they cite, the case the Secretary cites for the proposition that you can't look at past penalties, you can't base your penalties, the ALJ can't base penalties on past decisions, is, of course, Jim Walters, which is 28 FMS HRC 579, and particularly pages 607, 608, 2006. There, the Commission held, quote, while it is not error for the judge to note the equivalency between the penalties he assessed and those figures, it is impermissible to use those figures to arrive at the penalties to be assessed in this case. Penalty assessment figures in other cases are not a factor recognized as relevant by Section 110I of the Mine Act, 30 U.S.C. Section 820I. The Commission has consistently ruled that in assessing penalties, a judge may take into account only the six criteria listed in Section 110I, close quote. So, to me, the question becomes, did the judge, in referring to these prior penalties, note equivalencies, or did he use those figures to arrive at the penalty to be assessed? Now, I interpolate on top of this a more recent decision of the Commission, which had not been issued by the judge at that time, so he could not have been taking the decision not yet issued into account. But since the judge ruled in this case, the Commission has ruled, apparently, that in addition to the six penalty criteria set forth in the statute, which are all the judge should look at, there may be, my opinion may be wrongly decided, but it is what the Commission held by majority, an overarching principle of deterrence, which to me may mean, and I think will be developed in future cases, that an administrative law judge could evaluate the six criteria and then say, but I'm also going to look at the overall scheme of the act and the purpose of deterrence and do something different with the penalty. That being the case, and the way I've read the judge's opinion, I believe the Secretary's counsel was essentially making a deterrence argument at the hearing. Basically, these penalties need to be where we've proposed for the purpose of deterring the operator from these kinds of violations in the future, looking at the history of past violations. So going to the paragraph that, I'll note the structure of the opinion was to go through each citation and identify the mitigating factors, what the judge found to be mitigating factors, except with respect to 6.3. So he identified the mitigating factors, and then at the end, after he's established, decided his final penalty, he does the parenthetical paragraph that Commissioner Nakamura read. And in that, he says, I recognize the Secretary's concern that Sequoia needs to display greater efforts to maintain its heavy-duty refuse trucks regardless of their operation under adverse conditions, which sounds to me like he is responding to what amounts to a deterrence argument. And in that sense, he may have been, in looking at these past penalties, simply saying they were this, 60 to 3, 2 or 300, and now they're 1,200 to 3,500, and I find that to be sufficient deterrence. So my thought on that was, and may still be, I'm interested in hearing everybody else, that this was an equivalency based upon an argument relating to deterrence. And part of that is, I think, when the secretary argues that penalties need to be higher to make the operator aware of their duty to conform with the law, they are implicitly arguing the penalties so far have not done the job. So whether the secretary identified specific amounts that had been charged in the past in their argument, it is on the history of violations, of course, but whether they identified specific amounts or not, they are implicitly saying what we find them in the past hasn't done the job. They need to be bigger to get the job done. So I think implicit in an argument on what amounts to a deterrence ground is the amount of the penalties. So I think the secretary put the proper amount of the penalties in the context of deterrence into play when the secretary argued that the penalties need to be higher to deter. That's reading the opinion. Now I go to the transcript. This is where Sarah causes me so much confusion. Sarah has given me, I have a right to have the transcript. I have the transcript, and there's several references to these penalties in the transcript. And going through the transcript, on three of the citations, the judge only refers to the penalty criteria. He makes no reference to prior penalties. On the citation for the 621, I don't know the first five numbers off the top of it, but the one that's 6-2, he does say on page 350 and 351, quote, "I sense a general frustration on the part of the Mine Safety Administration about the operator not giving enough attention to pre-shift reports and timely addressing citations. And what I'm trying to do here is somehow come to a resolution that is, each side gets a sort of half a loaf or whatever. Because if you look at the history of violations, these are a lot of similar violations that are at issue in this case, and the proposed penalties and the penalties that were paid were somewhere between 60 and 2 or 300. So occasionally there was a $400 penalty, but nothing to the magnitude of the total $40,000 penalty and $4,600 for each citation, $4,689. So in reaching this conclusion, for example, of $1,400 and $1,200, and we'll get to the remaining two, I want to note that I'm doing it in the context of I'm significantly raising the previous penalties, but I'm not raising them as much as the Mine Safety Administration, Mine Safety and Health Administration has raised them, with the recognition that there's some frustration, and I would hope that maybe the company would put a little greater emphasis on trying to get a handle on keeping, you know, on maintaining the equipment. Now, that's capable, and this is what causes my mind to teeter on the top of the triangle. That could be read either way. That could be clearly read as clearly he's basing these on the past penalties because he says these are enough. But it could also, in my mind, be read that he's responding to a secretary's desire to increase the penalties to encourage compliance. And if that's the case, and if the commission says deterrence is an overarching issue, then he was staying within the penalty criteria. If deterrence has become a penalty criteria, and he was talking about deterrence, then he's within the penalty criteria. So he is obeying the criminal penalty criteria. So whether it's up or down, I mean, I can see if deterrence is a penalty criteria that the secretary may at some point propose a $25,000 penalty, and a judge go through all the six factors and say, you know, I think that's right, except I think we need deterrence here. So I'm going to make it $40,000. Now, I don't know how the commission would react to that. It would be clearly going outside the criteria, the six statutory criteria, but it would be relying upon a deterrence factor. So as long as deterrence remains a potential element of determinations of penalties, and if what this judge was doing was addressing a deterrent issue, albeit before the Black Beauty case was decided, then I would tend to say what he did was okay. Now, I will look at the very back of his opinion, in fairness to the secretary. He does say, when he's wrapping up the decision, he says, frankly, I think that what I'm imposing is, the penalties I'm imposing is relatively high given the history of violations and the previous penalties. But again, I'm hoping that if as a result of this case, there's some improvement could be made with regard to the keeping on top of some of the violations, Again, I really urge the parties to look at these defects in equipment, and particularly the secretary, and when it comes to judging what the proposed penalty should be and the negligence should be, that you look at the degree of hazard that it posed, and some defects posed more hazards than others. And again, anything that I've said is supported really by looking at the history of violations and the proposed previous penalties, as we have a lot of defect and equipment violations that were designated as significant and substantial. And even the significant substantial ones were proposed penalties of $350. So I'm proposing is really significantly higher than in the past. That's at pages 357 and 358 of the transcript. So it does make me hesitate as to whether he is out of step with Jim Walter in basing the penalty decision simply on these past penalties, or whether he's taking the history of violations and the past penalties into account in deciding what's the proper amount of a penalty here to achieve the overriding deterrent objective of the Act in accordance with the 6 statutory criteria. I completely understand what Commissioner McNamara said about the Minor Act. I actually give that a little less weight because, first of all, I'm perhaps wrongly, but pretty confident that a experienced, long-time administrative law judge was aware of the Minor Act. I was aware that the Minor Act had substantially increased penalties. And I don't think he was using, I think he was, if using these penalties, he was using it for an equivalency on what would be the right amount to help prevent these kind of violations in the future. And as of today, I think that's appropriate. And so I would affirm the use. I would not reverse him on the grounds that he based these penalties on penalties in prior cases. With respect to the particular citations, I think the judge was, with respect to all of the citations except 749-6263, did give explain mitigating factors. Secretary argues that if he found them significant and substantial, then he can't have mitigated on the grounds of gravity, but gravity and significant and substantial, although similar in concept, are not equivalent under our case law. He does find moderate negligence on, does reduce the negligence on one or the other. So I would find with respect to 749-6260, 749-6262, and 749-6266, I would affirm his penalties there. 749-6263, Judge Nakamura has given a reasonable interpretation of what his reasons may be. I don't see any reason expressed, though, in the opinion, so my initial thought there is to vacate and send that back for a look by the judge at a new determination, whether he revises it or not. My one little, and this is a discussion for a later day in another case, I guess, is it's where there's a substantial reduction. Our case law says it's where there's a substantial reduction in penalty. And, of course, a 40 or 50% reduction is substantial. But should we only look at percentages or should we look at amounts? I mean, I could see somebody arguing that 5,500 to 3,500 is not a, really in the scheme of life, substantial monetary reduction, but it is a substantial percentage reduction. Don't think we have to decide that in this case. I don't think it's fleshed out enough. But I think it's something we should deal with in the future. As to the Secretary's request that we simply institute the penalties now, even though they say, the Secretary says, that the cases in which we've done that are not directly applicable, I think it's incumbent that both the government and operators deserve to have penalties imposed not out of judicial economy, because we just don't want to waste time on it, but according to the penalty scheme and the degree of the 6 criteria, so I would not even consider us imposing those penalties. Thank you, Chairman Jordan.
Thank you. Commissioner Allison, can I just confirm, I think you said that you would affirm the judge on, is it three out of the four?
Three out of the four, yes, sir, Chairman. I would affirm the judge on, let me get the citation numbers here, sir. Because I don't find merit in the first overarching argument, I would affirm the judge on 749-6260, 749-6262, and 749-6266, and vacate and remand 749-6263.
Okay, thank you. Next, Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate very much the remarks of my colleagues and find a lot of common ground with them on this case. I would agree with Commissioner Nackmer that penalties can be confusing, but I don't want to say that too loudly because the Secretary seems bound and determined to make it simpler for us. Whether in another context or in the context of this case where they propose that we simply just shoot what she proposed in the first place, and I agree with my colleagues, we ought to not do that. I agree perhaps somewhat more strenuously on that point, and I'd like to discuss a little bit further the Jim Walters situation and the Black Beauty case, because there's no reason in the world for Judge Feldman to have brought up the previous penalties assessed against this operator for these types of violations except as a basis for injecting his own subjective opinion on what was appropriate for deterrence in this case. If you look at how he uses those penalties, how he discusses them, it is a ringing endorsement of the concept that what he has arrived at is fair and appropriate and adequate to meet the deterrent purpose of the act. So what Judge Feldman has done, which in my opinion is wrong and is error, in this case, is to inject his own subjective opinion regarding deterrence. I don't see that as being anything different from what Judge Miller did in the Black Beauty case, which was to inject her subjective opinion about what is adequate for deterrence. As we noted in JWR, you're supposed to use the six factors in 110I. That's it. When you use those factors, it's well expressed in a statute. You know what is supposed to be addressed. If the judge brings something else into the equation, something else to the party, you know it doesn't belong there. And the analysis is made simpler because you can just cut out the things that don't apply under the statutory scheme as it was designed. One concern Commissioner Duffy and I had in the Black Beauty case, which we expressed, was if you don't have any standards for guidance for the judges and how they apply this, you could possibly have 20 different subjective opinions on what deterrence means. Now, as a practical matter, I think we understand that we as a commission probably are never going to go in and say, that was appropriate for the judge to decide that reducing the penalty was enough of a deterrent without any further explanation, because that's contrary to our cases that say the judge has to make an adequate explanation for any substantial deviation from the penalty. So you kind of get into a logical box canyon. To me, it seems similar to the idea where the Supreme Court says we're going to draw in foreign laws to decide how to decide our own cases. Which foreign laws? Well, the ones that I, as a judge, individually, subjectively think are appropriate to this case. I think it's an unprincipled thicket that we've wandered into, and this is kind of the result that you get if you don't have some kind of rigor and discipline. Having said all that, it's important that judges understand and have confidence in our willingness to protect their ability as judges to decide these issues. Penalty is something that is committed to our judges by the Act. It is their responsibility to make those determinations. Now, the way they make the determinations has to rest on the evidence of the case, the factors expressed in the law. The problem I have in this case is that I think that there were other things, extraneous factors, that affected the decision, and that's evident by the fact that when you look at the facts relied upon by the judge in deciding other issues in the case, they typically and often in this case do not correlate to the findings that he makes in terms of what penalty is appropriate in the case. I would hold, you know, there were some of these penalties that I was tempted to say, well, we ought to just give the secretary what she requested, for example, on the hydraulic oil, you know, because every predicate finding that the secretary sought, every underlying finding, the judge agreed with, except for one, and in that he increased the negligent level from moderate to moderately high. I would submit that it's not logical to look at the secretary's proposed penalty, agree with everything except say it's perhaps worse, and then reduce the penalty at all without explaining how you arrived at that conclusion. It doesn't mean that it can't be done. It doesn't mean that it has to be explained, and we've said that. So for the hydraulic oil violation, I think we have to remand that and allow Judge Feldman to assess a penalty based on the other findings in the case regarding the gravity in particular. And you know, I think he does a good job analyzing what the problem is with this violation. And I agree with his assessment of the situation, previously noted in logbooks, unrepaired, a degree of you know, possible ignition hazard, gravity involved if there were to be a fire in the engine of this vehicle. So all of this is appropriate to consider. I just believe the judge needs to have another opportunity to review that penalty. Similarly, with the other violations for the trucks, except for one, I think when you're looking at the violations for the mirrors, for the lights, all of these things, he doesn't necessarily disagree with the secretary. And in terms of how he's looking at factors that might affect his assessment of the situation, they might be adequate to explain the reduction in penalty, except that he's already found these violations to be S&S. And I think once you make those findings, this is a serious matter. It is a serious matter, and while the secretary's penalty proposals developed under Part 100 are not sacrosanct and aren't binding on us, they're not developed arbitrarily or you know, on some type of whim or guess. I mean, these are professionals working to try to figure out what is the appropriate level of sanction for a given violation. It is worthy of our respect and our consideration. I agree with Commissioner Alton. At some appropriate time, perhaps we're going to have to decide what a substantial deviation is. You know, whether it's a penalty that is reduced by a certain percentage or a certain dollar amount, or whether it is just a reduction that affects the way the violation is likely to be perceived by the recipient of the intended message, which is, hey, you know, we issue these penalties to let you know you've got to do better. And if it's a penalty change that affects the characterization of that, but there's no way to know without having the appropriate case before us, and I'm convinced this is not this case. So I would remand those as well. The one penalty that I think the judge honestly perhaps was defensible in reducing, and I'm inclined to affirm him on his reduction, his reduction of the penalty, is the backup alarm, number 63. In that violation, the defect was not caused by an actual physical defect in the device itself or in the truck itself. It was caused by an impediment raised by environmental conditions, these muddy conditions. Because that's the case, it's the judge, I think, appropriately found that you know, if the operator said, well, our remedy was to clean this thing off when it happened, and I did clean it off, there's substantial evidence, there's testimony to support that, and the judge is free to credit that testimony. Even though it wasn't remarked in the books that the problem was fixed, it's not like they had to replace something. It just had to do with, you know, attention when the truck was cleaned periodically. Also, the alarm was not totally inaudible, although it was not effective for its intended purpose and was therefore properly sighted. But it it was not affected in a way that was necessarily uniform or predictable. Furthermore, the judge found that the level of negligence should have been reduced in that case, and I would agree with him on that. I think it's supportable by substantial evidence when you look at the facts of the situation. I'm not sure that at a typical operation it would occur to you to move the alarm. Eventually, with enough nudging, it got to that direction. But you know, the judge, I think, is on sound footing in deciding that the negligence level could be reduced for that violation. So I would affirm him on that one, but I would vacate and remand everything else with instructions to consider. My personal view is that he should only consider the factors in 110I. I think that's the way the Act ought to operate, and I think that we've seen through operation of this case, we've kind of seen through the lens of what we're likely to get in the future in the wake of the Black Beauty decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I also want to thank Sarah for the memos she's put out, for answering my questions, for being very available to talk about this case and help me get through it. It's interesting because this morning we had something that was pretty easy and we all agreed on, and here we've had three commissioners speak, and if I'm hearing you all right, we've got three different views of the case.
I think that's right.
So let me chime in.
Now we're going to hear four?
Four.
Are we going to hear four right now?
You may. In significant part, yes. Or in, at least in part.
Is this going to be a substantial deviation from our position? Or?
It may not be a substantial deviation from Commissioner Nakamura, but in part. The principal issue here involves the judge's use of the prior penalties assessed against Sequoia by MSHA. I believe the judge abused his discretion in the way he did this. For that reason, I think that all four penalties should be vacated and remanded. In terms of the distinction between, quote, noting prior proposed assessments and, quote, relying on them, which was created in the Jim Walter Resources decision, which was cited in the Secretary's brief and discussed by Commissioner Alton, I think this is a very difficult test to apply. I don't understand why a judge would ever note a past penalty proposed assessment unless something about that assessment or that group of assessments was important to the judge. And if the past assessments were important enough to be noted, I would think that the judge more than likely relied on them in some way. But in any event, it's clear to me that Judge Feldman in this case did rely, and here I think I'm different from everybody else, did rely on the past penalty proposed assessments to reduce the penalties he assessed in this case. And I'm saying that largely based on the third violation, number 7496263, which, as my colleagues have noted, the judge affirmed the S&S finding and actually raised the level of negligence from moderate to, quote, at least moderately high, and then without further discussion reduced the penalty from 5503 to 3500. And the only explanation for this, I think that's possible in looking at the whole opinion, is that the judge was relying on MSHA's past penalty proposed assessments, or past proposed penalty assessments. Now, there's an underlying issue here of whether a judge can ever permissibly utilize past proposed assessments in determining his or her assessed penalties. And I'm not sure that this issue is really resolved by the Jim Walter decision because of the inherent difficulty in distinguishing between noting past proposals and relying on them. I'm inclined to think that as a general rule, judges should not use past penalty proposals by AMSHA in determining their penalties. And this is not because of the language of Section 110I. Here I depart, I agree in the result, but depart from Commissioner Young in the reasoning, I think. But rather, it's because AMSHA should not be constrained from changing the ways it proposes penalties so long as that process is not arbitrary or capricious. AMSHA is, after all, the executive agency charged by Congress with the primary responsibility to enforce mine safety laws, and the penalty process has been established by Congress as one of the principal means of accomplishing compliance with the Mine Act. However, I think in this case it's probably not necessary to revisit Jim Walter to determine whether or when past proposed assessments may be used by judges in their assessments of penalties. And that's because, to my view, there are two clear reasons why the Commission should find that the judge in this case abused his discretion in his use of the evidence of the past proposed assessments. First, as the Secretary points out and as Commissioner Nakamura discussed at considerable depth and length, the judge did not recognize that the Miner Act passed in 2006 and the 2007 amendments to the penalty system contained in Part 100 of the regulations significantly changed the penalty system under the Mine Act. As stated in the preamble to the new penalty regulations, quote, the final rule results in an across-the-board increase in penalties from the existing regulations, unquote. Having said that, I'm not sure that I can really add anything to what Commissioner Nakamura said on that issue. But I think that there's a... Well, no, before I get to that. I would add there that some of the penalties that the judge considered here, the past ones, were $60 so-called single assessment penalties, which are not used under the present system. So when the judge said, well, in the past it went from $60 to whatever it went to, I think that's completely irrelevant. I have reviewed the record in terms of how AMSHA calculated the four proposed penalties in this case, and here I disagree with Commissioner Alpha. In terms of the point system, including the size of the mine and the controller, the history of previous violations, negligence, and gravity, AMSHA's calculations of each of the four penalties in this case is precisely in line with Part 100. Precisely. Now, I'm not suggesting that Commission judges are bound by AMSHA's proposed penalties, nor are they bound by the Part 100 regulations. This is an issue of a lot of controversy, as Commissioner Young mentioned, and I'm personally fully in accord with the Commission's position on the question of our adherence to Part 100. However, the comparison of the proposed penalties in this case with Part 100 does clearly show that the past proposed penalties utilized by the judge are really irrelevant to the proper assessment of the penalties for these violations. Now, the second reason I think that the judge erred, as the Secretary points out in his brief, the evidence relied on by the judge in making the comparison does not contain sufficient or precise enough information to enable a judge to make a reasonable comparison to past proposed penalties. Government Exhibit 12 is a standard AMSHA computer printout entitled Assessed Violation History Report. It's a document used to demonstrate an operator's violation history in terms of the number of violations and the regulatory standard involved in each violation. There's not enough information in the printout, particularly with regard to the key presently emphasized factors of size of the operator and controller, negligence, and gravity, to enable a judge to use it for any purpose other than to review an operator's violation history. it certainly, in my view, cannot be used to determine the appropriateness of present proposed penalties. Now, in addition, and so for that reason, I would remand all four, as Commissioner Nakamura suggested. In addition to the use of the past proposed penalties, the judge's analysis of the four violations raises other issues which I think the Commission should address. Preliminarily, I would say that I do not agree with the Secretary's argument that the factors which the judge listed as mitigating may not be considered as mitigating factors if they are also matters which are considered as potentially aggravating factors in an unwarrantable failure analysis. A judge should not be constrained in his or her consideration of factors relevant to a penalty assessment because those penalties may also be relevant to another part of the legal analysis of the case. On review, what the Commission looks at in reviewing a judge's assessment is the way the judge addressed the factors, whether the judge's consideration was rational and in accordance with law, and whether it's supported by substantial evidence. With regard to the first citation, 7496260, this violation involves a leaky exhaust pipe and a defective high and low beam headlights on the right side of a refuse truck. In addition to affirming the fact of this violation, the judge affirmed the S&S designation, at least as to the leaky exhaust pipe, and the finding of moderate negligence, which the inspector made. However, the judge found several mitigating factors. In my view, some of the so-called mitigating factors identified by the judge were properly considered as such. For example, I think the judge acted within his discretion in finding that additional driving lights installed at the top of the truck mitigated the hazard caused by the defective right headlights and thus affected consideration of the gravity of the violation. I might not have come to that conclusion, but I think it was within the judge's discretion to do that. However, I believe that at least two of the mitigating factors identified by the judge in this case lack substantial evidence. First, the judge found that there was, quote, no evidence, unquote, that Sequoia ignored defects reported as a result of the pre-shift examinations. The judge noted that the MSHA inspector identified that the pre-shift examination referred to lights, but then downplayed this evidence because, quote, the pre-shift report had not been proffered in evidence by the secretary, unquote. That's the judge's words. However, not only did Inspector Brock testify that the defective lights had been noted in the pre-operational reports, but he also testified that the leaky exhaust pipe had been noted in the pre-operational reports for several days. The judge made a statement that the inspector did not contend that the leaky exhaust pipe was noted by the pre-shift examiners. And that statement is not only unsupported by substantial evidence, but it is directly contrary to the evidence. That testimony, by the way, was unrebutted by the operator. Equally or more significantly, the judge failed to recognize the reason why the pre-operational reports had not been offered in evidence by MSHA. The secretary had requested these reports from Sequoia in discovery, but they had not been produced by the operator. Sequoia suggested that because of a company policy to retain these documents for only 30 days, they had been destroyed. But this was a situation where Sequoia had been cited by MSHA, and the pre-operational reports obviously constituted relevant evidence. Sequoia's destruction of the pre-operational reports under these circumstances is, in my view, tantamount to spoliation of evidence. Rather than holding that the non-existence of the pre-operational reports in this record went against the secretary, the judge should have drawn a negative inference against Sequoia for its failure to retain obviously relevant evidence. The negative inference would be that the pre-operational reports contained information about the defective leaky exhaust pipe and the defective headlights, which Sequoia had, in fact, ignored. Second, the judge found that the leaky exhaust pipe was not apparent because there were no visible holes in the truck's exhaust system. The judge said that the defect was apparent only when the engine was started. In this regard, the judge did not, I do not believe that the judge considered evidence, which he had noted earlier in the decision, that about the soot buildup because of the leaky exhaust. And he also ignored the evidence that the fumes from the exhaust could be smelled. Hence, I question whether the judge's finding that a defective exhaust system was not apparent was, in fact, supported by substantial evidence. Additionally, on remand, I think the judge should resolve the tension between his finding of S&S and his finding of mitigating factors with regard to the gravity of the violation. With regard to citation number 749-6262, this violation includes defective side view mirrors and defective headlights on another truck. As with the previous violation, the judge affirmed MSHA's findings of S&S and moderate negligence, but found mitigating factors. One of the mitigating factors relied on by the judge was that the truck was not dumping in the vicinity of elevated areas. Thus, the judge found that the hazard caused by a totally missing lower side view mirror was reduced. But in the previous paragraph of his decision, in analyzing the S&S issue, the judge found that it was, quote, likely that this haulage truck will be operated under circumstances that require a lower side view mirror to ensure that the vehicle does not back through a berm installed in an elevated area, unquote. This finding strikes me as inconsistent with the finding of a mitigating factor, because the truck does not do its dumping in the vicinity of elevated areas. Perhaps the judge was drawing an unstated distinction between gravity for purposes of S&S and gravity for purposes of assessing a penalty. We don't know. But what we do know is that this truck traveled through elevated areas and going back and forth between the refuse bins at the preparation plant and the refuse pile on a hill a quarter mile away. Inspector Brock testified that the trucks travel at night through a hilly area that has a winding road that can get wet and slick. In such circumstances, if something should happen to the truck, not having a lower side view mirror could certainly be hazardous. Hence, I question whether the mitigating factor found by the judge of not dumping in elevated areas is supported by substantial evidence. The judge should, at the very least, reconcile the finding of this particular mitigating factor with his other finding and the surrounding circumstances of where the truck is driven. With regard to citation number 749-6263, the hydraulic oil, I think everything that needs to be said has been said. The judge did not explain why he reduced the penalty from $5,503 to $3,500 at the same time while increasing the culpability of the negligence, the only factor that he changed. And the absence of the explanation requires vacating that penalty and remanding it to the judge. On citation number 749-6266, this violation involves an inoperable backup alarm on a third truck. Here the judge affirmed the S&S designation, but found only moderate negligence instead of the high negligence cited by the inspector. Although the judge recognized that the lack of a functioning backup alarm was very hazardous and that the backup alarm had been at least intermittently non-functional for a considerable period of time, the judge found that muddy conditions were a mitigating factor. This was the judge's basis for reducing the negligence from high to moderate. I'm not so sure that muddy conditions really are a mitigating factor. It seems to me that muddy conditions are common where mine trucks travel, that having a functioning backup alarm is extremely important, and that the operator figured out how to reconfigure the backup alarm so as to avoid the mud problem. However, the Secretary has not appealed the judge's reduction from high negligence to moderate negligence, and I am not at all sure, and I'm thinking that the Commission maybe should not get into that issue, but should only remand the fourth violation on the question of the use of the past proposed assessment history. In summary, I would vacate the penalties and all the penalties and remand the case to the judge. But as a final thing I want to say, the secretary has raised an argument that the commission should simply reinstate the penalties which MSHA proposed in the interest of, quote, judicial economy. And I'm somewhat appalled that the secretary would make this kind of argument, which contains within it the suggestion that, well, he raised one, he lowered the other, they're a wash, commission, you just set the penalties just the same way we did it. As we were saying earlier today with regard to the other case, it's up to the judge to set the penalties and then the commission can review them. Certainly, the judge is not bound by the proposed penalties. The proposed penalties conform to the point system, but the judge can make different findings and can adjust the penalties. And I just can't see why the secretary would make that kind of argument to the commission. I mean, I think that there were some other arguments that the secretary could have made in this case and didn't. Why they made that one, I don't understand.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen.
May I ask you something, Madam Chair, just because I think it would be helpful to Sarah. Well, first, Sarah, I neglected to thank you for the work you did in spiriting out the some of the problems with the way the evidence had been characterized and providing the record evidence for us to rely upon. And I do appreciate that very much, as well as your overall management of this case. What I wanted to say was that almost everything Commissioner Cohen said, beginning with his very thoughtful analysis of the reasons why the consideration of the past penalties should be irrelevant, why they're irrelevant, and why MSHA should not be bound, through his discussion of the mitigating factors, everything really up to the discussion of citation ending in number 66 with the backup alarm. Up to that point, the point of that discussion, I would endorse and agree with as very well expressed and it as additional bases for my own position. However, I resolve to approach the individual things. I think he's provided a great core in terms of how we view this thing in gross. So I just wanted to endorse most of what he said there and make it clear to you for that purpose.
Thank you. I think that was helpful. Makes me a little more optimistic that besides our votes, we may actually get an opinion drafted, which will be the equally a challenge, I think. Although maybe not too bad. I find myself in agreement with a lot of what my colleagues have stated. In particular, I join Commissioner Nakamura and Commissioner Cohen's view that the judge's noting of the prior proposed penalties and the great discrepancy gives me enough discomfort that I would vacate these penalties and remand them, you know, to allow the judge the opportunity to reconsider these penalties with the actual knowledge that they're not a departure from the current proposed standards, that the prior penalties were under a different formula system. I have great respect for our judges and, you know, their knowledge, but the fact that there was no mention of the increase in the penalties due to regulation changes, just I'm not able to feel as confident as my colleague Commissioner Alton that the judge made his determinations with that in mind. And what worries me is that somebody who notes such a great discrepancy from a prior action of the government, that they may, you know, somewhere also be considering that these proposed penalties that have come before them reflect some arbitrary action or vindictiveness or something, and that just causes me enough discomfort that I'm not able to affirm the judge's action on the penalties. I agree with my colleagues that we have here, our judges do have wide discretion in assessing the penalties, but as our precedent has indicated, they do have to have an explanation when they significantly depart from the penalties that have been proposed. And I believe the penalties here do significantly depart, although I'm not proposing that we try and tease that out or get into that in this case. Sarah's breathing a sigh of relief. I think you've made a good point, and maybe, you know, as things come before us, we may start to, you know, provide some more thought on that. But here, you know, we're talking about reductions in the nature of 74%, or it's, you know, the minimum is 36% departure, and that to me it's a significant reduction, and so therefore it requires quite a bit of explanation. And I think that I'm not going to try and repeat all that my colleagues have said here. I think that they have pointed out, I know Sarah and some of your memos to us have pointed out actual factual basis where the judge has not really his findings, either as Commissioner Cohen has pointed out in some examples, don't seem to be supported by the record. To me, another thing that I noted is that almost in each of these cases, the judge, maybe all of them, he sort of affirmed findings of moderate negligence, and then he kind of went on to say, but here's mitigating factors. Now, you know, when I look at the Secretary's proposed penalties and I see that they're, the way that they calculate, moderate negligence, the number, the points that they assign for that, already assume that there's mitigating circumstances. And so it's a little odd to read the judge's decision to moderate negligence. His decision is as though there had never been any consideration that there were mitigating factors in the original proposed, you know, in the proposed penalty that was before him. So that causes me some concern. And I agree with, I think we're all, I guess the one action on the one penalty, 6-3, we seem to, I think we are unanimous in at least vacating and that one. And I just will put my view in that I agree. I think the judge's action there requires some explanation. I don't understand why he made that significant reduction. At one point, I think he described the violation at issue there as the proverbial, quote, accident waiting to happen. So I don't know, you know, what justified his decision to then really reduce that penalty. With regard to the last penalty, the backup alarm, I don't understand how muddy conditions are a mitigating factor. Maybe if the muddy conditions affected the backup alarm and the backup alarm had been out of service for a short period of time, and you might, the muddy conditions prevent it from working, they didn't get, you know, to clean it right away. And here, I believe the backup alarm, it has been noted as non-functional for several months. Now, if that's the case, it's hard for me to know what mitigating conditions are present there. So I would see not really substantial evidence for decreasing the negligence finding as the judge did, and I just think that was an error to consider the muddy conditions mitigating. At some point, like I said, even if you had a muddy situation, and as Commissioner Cohen pointed out, I don't know, the mine trucks, they're probably often operating in mud, but even if you were to think about it being mitigating, that condition doesn't stay mitigating if something, you know, if you're ignoring it for months. So that is my view. I think that, Sarah, I guess you're probably keeping a scorecard. I was trying to. I'm not sure that I gave up or continued, but I knew you would be keeping that. And so I think that the challenge, I think, to my colleagues also is to consider how, you know, how an opinion is fashioned here. And it sounds like to me that there's going to be at least some parts where there'll be some splits off, perhaps, you know, concurring or whatever. And the issue of the overarching consideration of the prior penalties and how that plays into a decision to act on the judge's decision here or not. And the question of the comment from the Jim Walter case, my thought is, I agree with some comments that my colleagues have made here, that I know that Jim Walter said, well, it was okay to note the prior penalties, but you couldn't rely on them. I think, I'm not sure what that means. I don't think I really want to emphasize that. I just feel that writing opinions that start to indicate how a judge's mind has to, you know, what you can note something but not rely on it. I tend to agree with comments that were made here. If you're noting something, it might indicate that you are affected by that. So, but I also agree with some comments that have been made here. I'm not sure at this point that it would constitute legal error enough to reverse a judge's decision on a penalty, because but I'm not totally decided on that. But I think that it's probably just realistic. It might be unrealistic to say somebody would ignore. I mean, if something was such a huge departure from prior action, it's probably natural you would at least be aware of that and might look further or just seek to reassure oneself that there's not some vindictiveness or arbitrary action going on here. So I'm not sure that I would want to issue an opinion that says you can never, you know, that it's legal error to do that. And I'm not sure that I have to do that here. To me, it's more like I'm just disturbed by the fact that I'm really not confident that the judge, you know, when he talked about, well, I've kind of cut the baby in half, or, you know, kind of giving you half a loaf. I think he was measuring his half from a false other end of the scale, you know, back in the days when they had the $60 flat penalty. And he was assuring himself, he kind of, you know, versus what the secretary is now asking me to assess here. And boy, this is such a wild departure, and I'm going to kind of cut it in half. I would just feel more comfortable allowing the judge at least another opportunity to kind of, all right, to be fully aware that the starting line did kind of move in the meantime. And then, but I think actually at this point, people have identified several specific facts relating to each of the penalty determinations by the judge. At least some of the commissioners, that would warrant a remand. And we're all unanimous on one of the penalties. So, good luck, Sarah. I maybe I should say that I did give some thought to the how an opinion would even issue here, you know, would it sort of be overarching or specific? And I've asked Liz, there's going to be a subsequent council meeting, and I know Push and Akamoris had a chance to review it, that in terms of just consideration of structure of an opinion, I mean, based on what's here, I know not everybody will be going along with the determination, but it might prove useful as some review of the structure, and I've asked Liz to provide counsel with that, and it's going to council will be meeting after the, you know, sometime after this meeting, for the purpose of trying to kind of figure out, you know, how an opinion should be structured. So you can expect to see that to perhaps provide be some use, or perhaps be something we can, you know, react against or figure out. There's majorities on certain aspects. Does anybody else have any comments or reaction to anything?
I have a question and a comment. The question for Sarah, was there anything in the record indicating that the operator had any role in installing, as it was originally installed, the backup alarm on that truck? I mean, I think they come with backup alarms installed. I mean, that's part of the equipment on those. But
I don't think there was anything in the record about how they originally installed it, whether it came on the truck that way or whether they decided to put it there.
Okay. I didn't recall that. And then the comment I had has to do with the chairman's observations and concerns about which I share, about not wanting to dictate to judges what they can and cannot discuss or allude to in any way. Regarding the past penalty amounts, for me, that is not in and of itself, in this case, the basis for me deciding to remand the penalties. My problem is that it only becomes an issue in the absence of any other apparent basis for reducing the penalties. If the judge had raised that, I think that's where you perhaps can see the distinction between noting something and relying on it, is that if the judge had raised the prior penalties and then had gone through and explained why, under the criteria that he was applying under 110I, he was reducing the penalties anyway, there's a basis for that upon which we can rely, and any discussion of the prior penalties, you know, the force of that becomes greatly diminished. That's the problem I have with that, is that it comes up in the context of there not being an apparent valid reason for reducing some of these penalties.
Chairman Jordan, as a new boy on the club, may I ask a stupid question? That is, in looking at the exhibit, the Secretary's Exhibit 12, History of Past Violations, it is, as Commissioner Cohen said, a printout, and one of the lists on it is the penalties for each of the previous violations. If we don't want the ALJs to take into account past penalties, can we request that MSHA, in preparing that exhibit, simply delete the column that shows what the penalties were?
Well, I don't think we want to do that.
I mean, if you're not supposed to use them, don't tell them what they were. I mean, I'm just throwing it out.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I'm not sure we've all decided.
Well, I know
that they can't, like, that it's.
Well, they can note them.
That they can, you know, exactly what role, or is it.
They can go like this a little bit, but they can't go like this a little bit.
Well, the penalties, the previous penalties may have a valid purpose. I think if you're looking at an operator's violation history and they start to trend upward and you still don't see a correction in the behavior, you've got an indication there. I think that.
So you'd say that's part of the history of previous violations criteria?
I think it could come into effect, and I would hate for us to do anything to preclude.
I mean, that's one of the logical problems.
Consideration of that exhibit as a whole.
The amount of the penalty is subsumed within the history of previous violations, then it is in fact the criteria, and so it wouldn't be error at all to take it into account because it's part of the criteria.
But I think it's just kind of as Commissioner Cohen explained.
Commissioner Cohen if you couldn't hear me, just groaned.
I'm not sure.
That's an interesting question.
I mean, in other words, to me, the criteria is the criteria, and either the penalty amount is part of the criteria or it's not. If it is, it can be taken into account, it seems to me.
The groaning, what you call groaning, was because when Emsh's penalty point formula looks at the...
mathematical equation.
It's a couple of mathematical equations, I think. What Commissioner Young is suggesting is that a judge's consideration of history of prior violations may be broader than those two mathematical equations and may be relevant for that. So it's
I have to confess how this came up is when Sarah and helping me prepare for the case, she gave me all the exhibits, or gave me that exhibit, and I looked down there and I said, well, here's the computer printout, and it's got all the penalties here, and if they're not really relevant, and if they're dangerous, as it were, maybe we should just wait out those. It's just an open question, and not the resolution. I mean, it just seems to me it's something to think about.
Regardless of what I think about Black Beauty, I mean, as a commission precedent, if the secretary offers that up and the judge looks at it and says, I see the penalties going up here and I don't see any corrective action by the operator, the previous amounts were insufficient to carry out the deterrent purposes of the act, there's a basis for making that finding and holding in our case law. So I don't think that we can go in or should go in and suggest that any part of that exhibit needs to be off limits for consideration by a judge. I think we ought to look at these case by case.
Maybe just use with great care stamped above it. Yes, it doesn't. The penalty amounts aren't taken into account in Emsh's calculations of the point system.
Yeah.
The amounts are not part of that history of previous violation formulation.
And I had kind of thought that perhaps it wouldn't be necessary to just sort of spell out in detail what role or not, or how one views it, or whether you can note it, and maybe this is not going to be possible, but without deciding that, to just alert the judge that the fact of the change in the formula and that his perception of it may not have taken in the whole picture. Anybody else want? Sarah, do you dare try and clarify anything at this point, or you may?
I think I have an understanding.
Okay.
Down
yeah, and I'm sure I speak for all my colleagues, and feel free to, come back to all of us to seek clarification or alert us to something, do we need to address this, or if we have too many fractured things, if we go into this, are you willing to go? Just feel free to follow up with any of us. All right, well, I thank OGC very much, and I thank my colleagues for their comments, which I found very helpful and thoughtful, and we'll go off the record.